Okay, that's good. All right, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Joe T. from Santa Maria.
Do you want that here?
I'm recording.
Okay, great. Great, great, great. I'm Joe, and I'm an alcoholic, and very glad to be here. And thank you, Kristen, for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope. And welcome, Janet. You know, I hope you fit right in. And this has been a great, great place. You know, I moved here from San Diego about 11 years ago. And, you know, it's the good thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. We're everywhere, so you know that's the good thing. Anyway, yeah, I have a little outline. Hopefully, I'll try and keep with it. If not, then I guess I'm not going to. So, anyway, what I wanted to say is, you know, I'm honored and very privileged to be sober today. That's the number one thing in my life, and that has changed. That changed about 20 years ago. When I had my last drink. And what I'm trying, what I hope to do is, you know, by what I share here, that whoever's here or whoever's going to listen to this, maybe walk away with an attitude that maybe it's a good idea just to stay sober, you know, because this disease is a killer, you know, it wants me dead, you know, and it took me a long time to figure that out. So I follow the program that's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found that to be the best design to do that. So I kind of went through and highlighted some of the pages or passages in the book that are pertinent to me, that really seem to illustrate what I was up against and how to get around that, or how, you know, how to coexist with that. So you know, I like to say that I heard in a meeting once that, you know, the Big Book, you know, has no pictures, but it has a lot of mirrors, you know, and that's absolutely true. And the more I'm around AA and practicing this program, the more I realize that there are a lot of mirrors in that. And it's great to be kind of grounded back to say, yeah, this is what I need to do. And I am forever grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous is on the planet, you know, because I can tell you 100%, I would never be able to be sober without this program. So I guess I'm going to follow an outline, like they say, you know, in a general way, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So go ahead and get started. My sobriety date is February 26, 2000. At 12 noon. And I'll kind of go into a little bit more of that when we get to that part. And I know exactly at 12 noon because it was that that much of an impact on my life that I knew exactly what it was. Okay, I was born in January 20th, 1956 in Chicago, Illinois. And from kind of a big family of 10, I was the second youngest. Right between the baby and the last girl. So that was kind of, they call it a middle child, even though there was a lot of children before that. So there was some different things, you know, going to therapy and stuff that may have caused, it didn't cause anything. I just reacted to it, you know, put it that way, you know. And it was a perfect opportunity for me to look for avenues to avoid reality, I guess is what, you know, my main issue is. Anyway, I went to Catholic school for 12 years. It was kind of mandated by my parents. It was in a pretty strict religious type family that you're going to go to Catholic school, and there is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. So, you know, I'm grateful that, you know, that happened. You know, it was the good things about it. But you know, they say in the book that, in the preface to the first edition, that we had, they had recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And, you know, the point there, they never talk about the drinking, you know, that we recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I knew I didn't know at the time, but going back through this program, I realized that that's what was behind the scenes almost immediately. You know, like to say, I could have used a drink on the way to kindergarten. You know, that's what was going on already. There was this uneasiness, you know, and I learned by working this program, that's another way of saying dis-ease. I'm not at ease, you know, and I didn't quite figure out why. There was always this kind of lurking element that things were not working out for Joe. I don't know. Or this feeling of, one way of saying it is inadequacy. You know, I was in things, I wasn't quite right. No matter what materialized, it just, man, wasn't working out. So I knew there was something out there that maybe could change that, you know. I don't know, I grew up in the 60s, and I don't know if any of you old enough to be in the 60s, but the 60s were like this cosmic convulsion of, you know, everything going on, you know. It's like, what the, it's like a disintegration of what was the normal. And so that brought into, like, a lot of different behaviors, you know. People were always aghast at what was going on day to day. And so I learned that maybe I could do something else besides try and deal with reality. What happened was I started early. I was an early adopter of alcohol, that's for sure. I had my first drink when I was 6 years old. Came from a European family, and they liked to drink, you know. And I was at my grandmother's house, and they would always have wine and everything, and they wouldn't finish it all. So I took it on myself. I'm going to down this stuff, you know. And, you know, I never, like, drank socially. I thought I was I wanted to drink to oblivion. And that's exactly what I did on my first encounter with booze, was I drank, and I liked the feeling of being kind of numb, you know. It was like I could bounce off of walls, and it was like, hey, this is great, you know. No, I mean, nobody's going to mess with me because they wouldn't care. And so I didn't really get caught, I think because everybody else was kind of drunk anyway. But I knew right then that I was going to hook up with booze again. I don't know how, I don't know when, but that was the magic. And there's a couple things I realized, but looking back, is that normal people or normal biology, they take a drink and they start getting sick. They don't want anymore. And so that was like the first indication, like I was headed for trouble, but I didn't mind because, like it says in the book, alcoholics drink mostly for the effect. Like, yeah, I'm going to get that. And it was there immediately. When I was, I didn't drink every day after that, but I would like sneak drinks, you know, because there was like booze around, and I'd always be looking for that, you know. It was kind of abnormal, and I would find it, you know. I'd find a way, and that's part of the disease that I never knew was creeping up on me, that we have to become pretty manipulative of how we're going to get that drink and, like, think nobody's going to notice. You know, that was the big surprise. It's like, whoa, you noticed I've been drinking. Oh, my gosh, how did that happen? I would wait until people weren't around or they were thinking about something else, and I would sneak in and drink. And that would go on for years. And however, like it says in the book, this is a progressive disease. And they mean progressive. So back, like in grade school, it's kind of like the early, I kind of broke this up as early, middle, and towards the end of my drinking career. I knew there was a problem, but my parents knew there was a problem. I mean, I was like in fifth grade, and I was brought home by the police for public intoxication. And I didn't think that was a problem. I thought, man, I shouldn't have drank that all that stuff under that kid's liquor cabinet, you know? Should have measured it or something. My parents were totally aghast, like, what are you doing, you know? And they're like, don't worry, it'll be okay, you know? which is one of the things that alcoholism does. You know, it says no matter how bad things get, it's going to be it's all right. You know, they say, I think in chapter 3, they say that that phrase, somehow, someday, we're going to control and enjoy our drinking. And that was always there, you know, and we pursued into the gates of insanity or death. And I didn't know I was going that far, but I thought, you know, yeah, you know, it's not that bad. You know, don't worry. At least I'm not, like, doing drugs, you know. I'm just doing booze, you know. Because that was kind of one thing that was prevalent in my family. Don't do drugs. You know, you might be able to drink and get around, get away with the drugs. You're off, you know, forget it was the end. And I went with it, you know. So just, okay, I'll do that. So I had, being in Catholic school, they kind of pay attention to you, you know. And if you're not toeing the line, they let you know, like, you're doing that. So me being, I don't know, I kind of developed this attitude, I guess, of being like a class clown. I had a problem with authority, you know, I guess. And who would have thought an alcoholic with a problem with authority? And they noticed it quite a bit. Just like in seventh grade, I'd gotten like expelled from the school. And my parents were totally like, what? You know, they could not believe it, that that was going on, you know. I had this kind of attitude, like, why? You know, I didn't do anything that bad, you know. The problem was that I would not follow the rules. You know, the rules were for somebody else, not me. And again, that's kind of back in that bucket of seemingly hopeless state of mind and body that I was not aware of at the time, but it was there. It was always in the background, which, you know, I found over the years of kind of reviewing my behavior and consistently looking at my behavior is that there's this thing of alcoholism, the primary symptom is denial. And I like to say that stands for don't even notice I am lying. You know, in fact, I kind of say to people I'm helping, if you're a good alcoholic, you got to have like a black belt in bullshit. You know, it's like you have to do that. Otherwise, how are you going to get to the next drink? It's like that was kind of like the grade school time that kept going, you know, even though I had many warnings like you shouldn't be doing this. And by high school, it was like, boy. To kind of accelerate. It's a progressive disease, you know. In high school, I would drink every weekend, you know. We'd go out and get somebody to buy us booze. If we didn't have enough money, it always ended up being Boone's Farm, Apple something. And that was, that, you know, so it didn't matter. As long as it did the trick, I was good, you know. And then I would do, like, antisocial things, you know. It's like we'd get drunk and do stuff. Try to get chased by the cops or something. And see, you know, that was the fun. You know, that's what we did. And I had, you know, I was working, which was pretty amazing. So I had money to buy that. I had to buy booze. And that's something else I found in this, looking back at my drinking history. I always kind of kept that job pretty secure. And not that I was a good worker, it was I didn't want to lose my money to drink, you know. And somehow I never did, you know. I was able to suit up, show up, get to work. But damn it, you know, don't make me stay 5 minutes late, man. I got to get home and get that drink or do something. And that was always there. There was always that background pressure of, my God, if you had my life, you would drink too, and you people are just in the way. You know, it's this never-ending struggle. You know, it's like, come on, just let me drink, and you know, that keeps going. It's like it continues. So, had my first DUI when I was 16 years old. They didn't call it DUIs back then. I don't know what they called it, but. 502 or something, I don't know. Yeah. It was Yeah, I got the DUI, but it wasn't my car, and the person didn't know I was in the car that owned the car, so it was kind of like, boom. But, you know, again, at the time, I thought, yeah, it's probably a good idea, you know. And so, again, this progression keeps kind of moving, allowing me to act more unskillfully, I guess is one way to say it. And here's the thing is, by this time, I was drinking to, like, kind of bury the past. There was a lot of chaos that I was kicking up, and I didn't want to deal with that. You know, I didn't want to deal with anything to begin with, let alone anything like bad news. So I would plan my whole life around booze. And you know, that's kind of, I know you people probably reminisce and you think that was the same thing was going on too. Is I swear, by the time I was like 25, I would have to, like, first thing in the morning, it's like, how am I going to get that drink? I was married. I got married at 25, and I had had a pretty good job. You know, it was okay, doing all right. But what happened there, and I can't pinpoint exactly where it happened, but it was a point in time that, like, I would play sports. You know, I play softball. Or I play tennis, or you know, pickup games of football, and that was fun. And then I noticed I would be drinking. It was drinking, and then maybe I was playing softball, or you know, I was. It had to be drinking, otherwise I wasn't going to participate. So realized, but looking back, that my world was becoming progressively smaller. You know, if it didn't have booze, I wasn't up for it. I'm doing it. And what are you going to do? You know, for me, I just kept pursuing it. And again, situations and your just general life attitude becomes one of, this really sucks. You know, they want me to go to a funeral, and I don't think they're going to be drinking there. You know, so I better bring my own. And go and check the air in the tire 6 times, you know, in a half hour, just to make sure, you know, like, oh, I'm good, don't worry. And that's the bizarre behavior that, you know, I would lie so much I wouldn't even know that I was lying, you know. And so that's, you know, that's how that wound up. So that continues on. And kind of later in the my drinking career, booze was calling the shots, you know, totally. You know, it was like, that's what I was going to do. I had a child at that time. I was married. And I would, I didn't know at that time, but what I was going on there was, I loved my child, I loved my wife, everything, but I had a drink. You know, there was a definite limit there. You know, don't cross that line or I'm going to drink at you. You know, it's like, so... Again, this disease demanded everything. I didn't know it at the time, but it was little by little, I was getting packaged into this, miserable human being, you know? Going on, let's see, here it is. Okay, in the late 1998, I got my third DUI, and just to know, I was... You can tell I was an alcoholic because when I got, I wasn't even driving. I was sitting there talking on my phone, and I was out, totally flabbergasted. And how did they do that? I wasn't even drunk, you know. I was standing, I was talking, and when the tox report came back, I blew a 1.8, you know, which is that's what happens, you know. I'm sober, I think, right? You know, I'm functioning. And no, I was not. I was intoxicated. So that was my last DUI, I think. Hopefully it's the only last DUI I'm ever going to have. And I was ordered to go to AA as part of the deal. You know, I got here from the state of California saying, you got to get here. And I did. You know, why not? The lawyer told me to. And, you know, I was not a willing participant in the Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the one they talk about in the book that was going to blot on to the bitter end. just drink, leave me alone, I'm fine, I'm gonna, you know, just get this over with, please, you know. So I got to, hey, you people are real nice. And I kind of, you know, the first thing I realized, I was around AA, I wasn't in AA, that you people kind of talked like and thought like I did. I don't know how that would happen. But it seemed like you were having a good time, and you were all right with it. And like I say, I like everything about AA except the not drinking part. I was pretty sure that I could get around that, you know, that I could, I'd manage to drink and still be okay. And I would do the steps, whatever, you know, to get them checked off. And that again was my resistance to life, really. I wasn't going to admit that I had a problem with alcohol. How could I? That was the one thing that was keeping me going. It's like, I would do anything but not give up drinking. that last year, I kind of started a chain of events that it became totally obvious that I had a problem. You know, I really did. And by that time, I would get to work in the morning and I'd be like shaking. And I'm like, oh my God, I got MS or something. You know, it's what's going on here, you know? And I found out that that was just my body shutting down, saying, we need booze. Come on, give me some booze. So they told me, I went to, I thought it was going to be like a little retreat. They said, Joe, you got to go to this center. You know, it was right around football season in the playoffs. And I thought, hey, I'm going to be able to watch the playoffs finally without a bunch of people telling me not to drink. And I got there, packed my bags, walked up, and they said, thanks. Come over here, take off your shoelaces, undo your belt, you know. You're not going to need any of this crap. It's like, leave it right here, you're good. And they're like, what the hell? And it was a nut hut. It's like, I thought I was here to be like babied into not being an alcoholic. And that was like the first like glimpse, like, this is a problem, man. Not, well, I didn't, wasn't going to own the problem, but I knew I was in, something was wrong here. This is not what I penciled in. And but I still was going to keep drinking. You know, don't worry, I was going to keep drinking, but this was not a good sign. I'm going to have to get better at lying or something. And I kept going, you know. So they let me out of that, you know. I still had a job, so that was good. They said, you should probably go to this outpatient. You know, you go for a couple hours at night after work. And the thing was, it wasn't AA. It was like a clinical thing. And I would go there, and they would talk, you know, like, you shouldn't drink. They gave me all the information about what happens to your mind, your body, psychologically, all of the fallout. And I'm there, okay, all right, that's good. So there was a six-week program, and about, I think it was about the fourth week into it, I said, well, this is pretty good, and they gave us a break, so I'd go drink, you know. I'd go out, and there was a liquor store right next to it, and they had those little martini cans, and I'd get four of them and down them in 15 minutes, you know. And I'd come back, and the rest of the program was pretty cool then. So, yeah, I like that. That's pretty funny. Thank God the counselor realized, like, this guy is not doing it. So he called me on it. It's like, holy. He said, Joe, I think you're shit-faced, you know, and you're not supposed to be drinking. This is an alcohol rehab. And I was like, so pissed off. I'm like, oh, my God. What do you expect? You know, I'm not causing any trouble at all. I'm trying to be a good guy. I'm not, you know, and it was like, And believe me, I was upset. I was like, I think I'm going to quit this thing, you know. I ain't doing this. And for some reason, I don't know if people were praying for me or what, but on the way home, it was a Friday, on the way home, I said, well, this is ridiculous. I didn't even get to finish that last martini. I'm going to stop and get a martini. And I got one, and I was drinking, and it tasted like really bad. It's like, what the, you know, and this is the amazing thing. I didn't even finish it. You know, and they're like, I don't know what was going on, but I just didn't want it. And that was February of 2000. So The next day was Saturday, and I think, man, that was a pretty weird day. You know, it's like, man, I don't want to tell the wife about this stuff. And thank God they were going to be leaving to go to my son's baseball practice. I wasn't driving at the time, so I had made arrangements with the liquor store to call and give me a case of martinis, like, really quick, you know. And they would, you know. I had them on speed dial, actually. And they were walking out the door. I knew I had exactly 1 hour for all this to happen. And something fell into my brain saying that you are going to lose everything. In fact, I felt like I had lost everything and that I was going to die a horrible death. And that was the first time that that thought came in. It was not my thought, believe me. I don't know where it came from. People say it's from a power greater than yourself, but it had to be, because it wasn't in my dialogue. And in the book, they talk about that, that in the chapter 3, they said we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. And that was it. It was like, wow. What am I going to do? You know, I sat there, I was like crying, almost like projectile tears. Like, what is going on here? There wasn't anyone around, but I was like broke. It's like, what am I going to do? So I went to, like I said, I'd been around AA, and there was a meeting that Saturday night. It was in Ramona, California. And I went to the meeting, a Saturday night meeting, and they would say, you know, any newcomers? No, not me. I've been drinking all the time. You know, by that time, that's the only way I could drink is go to AA meetings. And and then they kept going, and then all of a sudden I raised my hand and go, no, you know, I'm a newcomer. And they're like, what are you doing? Don't do that. And it was like, ta-da, wow. And nobody fell out of their chair. Nobody said, Joe, you broke AA. How did you? What? You've been lying to us. You know, and it was like, thank God, you know, at that point I didn't care. I had to come clean. I don't know, again, where that came from. I think I was like struck sober. And they also, you know, they said, thanks, you know, keep coming back. And I remember this clearly. And that's, I was walking out of the meeting. Somebody patted me on the back. I don't even know who it was. And they said, Joe, the program works better if you don't drink. And that is absolutely true, you know. Because I would kind of like pretend to work the program, but I'd have a drink first to see how I was going to do that. Totally, totally whacked. So going on from there, that was the turning point for me. And I realized that I needed to go to meetings and actually listen. Like, my life depended on, I got a sponsor. I liked a sponsor because I didn't pick him. He shared in a meeting once, and he had come up with something. He said that in his drinking career, he was like me. He had to hide everything. And one thing he'd have to do, Southern California gets pretty hot. He would put his booze, his vodka into a hose, a water hose, and drink it out of a water hose hot. And they're like, oh, God. That's my guy, you know. If he's willing to do that, then he's probably just as sick as I am, you know. And he gently showed me how to read the book, start being willing to change my life, you know, one day at a time. That's all I could handle. In fact, that's all I can do. You know, I realize now that's all I can do. Even 20 years later, as I just have to do it today. So, what it's like now is it's a lot easier. Put it that way. You know, my life has become much simpler. I guess is one way of putting it. I follow what's outlined in the book. They say on awakening. Page 86, I ask God to direct my thinking, keep it divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. And I really focus in on that I have to be willing to let a power greater than myself, which usually for me manifests as stillness in my head, you know. I don't know about you, but I've got this itty-bitty shitty committee in my head that likes to divert stuff, you know. It usually has a strong element of self-pity. Like, Joe ain't getting his way. Should have went that way. He ain't gonna, and it's like, And, you know, I'm being much quicker at understanding that and cutting it. It's like I have to use step three. I have to let go of that or get dragged. You know, that's it. I will get dragged. So that's how I start my day. I have kind of an engineering background, so I like sequences, and that's pretty important. I've heard many times, and I believe in myself, my disease wakes up 10 minutes before I do. And it's already there. It has the agenda and how it's going to be kind of a crappy day. And it might be a good day to drink, too, John. So the other thing that I do on a regular basis is I go to a meeting. I find what's a meeting. And I ask God to direct my thinking. The next thought is, what meeting am I going to today? And, you know, I used to have a longer list, and I just kind of gave up the rest of the stuff. It's like, I'm just, those are the two things. If I do that on a regular basis, my life becomes okay, you know, which is, again, part of the steps. Practice steps one, two, and three, like, on a constant basis in my head, because my disease is made up of my dispute with reality a lot. You know, I don't like what's going on right now. What the heck? That shouldn't be. And that starts the, it creates a fear within me that I'm not going to get what I want. I'm going to lose what I have. And I read that in the 12 and 12, that self-centered fear is the chief activator of my character defects. And they're right. You know, believe me, I can be sober a long time, but if you cross that line, hey, here comes those character defects. I call them the weapons of self that I walked in with. And they were pretty, well used, put it that way. And this program and my sponsor and just working the program gives me the courage to put that stuff away and to use the tools of the program, which ultimately is a kind of is at a minute-to-minute basis. I have to be willing to let go of my idea that I'm right and the universe is wrong. Then that's kind of what it comes down to. If I don't, I'm picking a fight with the universe and or reality, either way you want to put it. And my unscientific observation of that is I lose 100% when I do that. And I also created quite a bit of suffering for myself and others. You know, believe me, if I get into, quote, the self-pity mode, everyone's going to share on that, folks. You know, you don't know. Let me tell you. And if you won't listen, I'll tell it to myself over and over again, all right? Let me rehearse that. Wait, I missed a point. Let me go back. That's right. And that is, again, a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body again. That that is always there, and that's okay. I've kind of come to not welcome it, but I don't fight it anymore. It's like, oh, there's that again. Okay, let's do what the program says. You know, I can, he can, I think I'll let him. And if I do that, a couple things materialize. One is I'm actually become present in my life again, you know, full time. It's like, whoa, this is good. You know, like, wow, look at the beautiful flowers and whatever. If I'm wrapped up in my thinking that usually is, and this is going to sound kind of weird, but you might relate, most of my time when I'm in this spin is about stuff that doesn't exist, you know. It's usually something that's in the past, that's just gone, or something that could happen in the future. So those two things I have absolutely no control over, but I'm at it. I'm going to get right on that, you know. Clear the decks. I'm going to fix that, you know. Might be fixing it about 20 years too late, but I'm going to be on it. Or I'm going to wrestle something that hasn't happened yet, which creates, again, suffering for me. I'm always looking for more spiritual knowledge or teachings. And one, the one that I like, or shows up, is the word enlightenment. And it says enlightenment is the end of suffering. And it doesn't mean suffering goes away. It just means I don't bring it in. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, I could do that anytime, couldn't I? You know? The difference is my ego says, no, we got the plan. We're going to make it. We're going to ratchet this into Joe's world and how it should work. Which, good luck with that, you know. The thing is, then nobody could ever take that away from me. So if I want to create suffering, good, go for it. You know, I can do it. But I'm getting much quicker to realize that nothing benefits from that, you know. In fact, the more if I'm going to be like that, I'm kind of like creating a lot of damage, not only in my mind, but in my body too, you know. That stuff goes right through to my cellular level. And it creates a lot of bad things, you know. Let's see. So after, if I go to a meeting, you know, I want to listen for what's going on there, you know. I've been in meetings. I don't know who said what, but they saved my life, you know. And so I still remember when my sponsor would say, he said, Joe, if you go to a meeting, listen like your life depended on it. And it does, you know. It may not be at that instant, but sometime maybe in the future, that clicks and goes, oh, that's right. That person did that, didn't they? You know, or maybe they had a better solution as to how to handle situations. Or even better, I run into some type of life event that somebody's already gone through. And they did it without a drink. So they proved that it can be done. I get that, again, by being an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous and be willing to listen to try to adhere to, you know, the principles of the program on a daily, minute-to-minute basis, really. So the other thing I do is I try to give back. I try to help other alcoholics, and that doesn't mean like anything. It means like maybe saying hi, making eye contact, you know, or just being in a meeting, you know, like you're helping me today just by being here at the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if I do that, a couple of great things happen. One is I can go throughout the day without like causing chaos for myself. There's a phrase in the book. They talk about we've given up fighting everyone and everything, and that's kind of key for me. Is I if I start this judgment about how things are wrong, people, places, and things are wrong, and you know, the funny thing about that is when I make a judgment, usually that's wrong and I'm right. And that's the beginning of my conflict, my separation from, put it that way. And that's one definition of the ego is a conscious separation from anything. And my ego loves that stuff. It's like, yeah, that should not be happening. So I've learned, like, I can have a judgment. It keeps happening. And I just say, yeah, thanks for sharing. I'm not going to listen to it. And I'm not doing that today because I know where it ends up. So by allowing, well, that, again, requires a power greater than myself to be present in my life, because my ego doesn't want to let go of me. It wants me to be special, you know. And so if I do that, I can find, well, there's this wonderful saying, I think it's a Zen saying, that my true self is like this still pond up, you know, in the mountains, which is very nice. That's my true self, and I can see what's going on. But emotions come, and they're like waves in the pond, and they mess everything up, and I can't see what's going on. It's all blur. So my responsibility is to calm those waves, not to make more of them, you know. My natural thing is like, oh, just mess it all up, you know. Somebody's problem, not mine. And that's, well, it's kind of immature and very, very unskillful, to tell you the truth. So, again, That for me involves using step three, which is, you know, I do all the steps, but all of them kind of have this thing where I'm going to have to change, and that requires me to let go and let God, or more specifically, let go or get dragged. So there's a phrase I heard in the meeting, and it really makes sense. It's they said, trust. You know, it stands for try really using step three, and that's really what I have to do. You know, I kind of like not having to give up my ideas of how things should be, which coincidentally are based in the past, and gamble on this unknown thing called the future. You know, what could happen? And it's that is kind of fearful. You know, the unknown is always kind of fearful, but it's also, I've learned the point of infinite possibilities too. That if I have a faith that, you know, God's taking care of stuff, the universe, creative intelligence, and I let that go, my resistance, then I have a chance to grow. And by the way, you know, in AA, there's a kind of an unwritten law. It doesn't really need laws, but it says, you know, either you grow or you go. You know, if I sit and say, oh, I'm done doing this sobriety thing because I've been doing this for 20 years, you know, I got it, I'm screwed. You know, little by little, I won't even notice the change in my behavior. It's kind of like this huge 20-foot screen with a million little pixels, and one by one, the pixels start changing until the whole picture is changed, and I don't even notice it. Like, wow. So I have to keep close to this program, as close as possible. So, you know, again, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous has a lot of pointers if I'm willing to take its advice. And the more I'm willing to do that, the easier life is. The easier it is for these ups and downs. And to tell you the truth, I've been through things that are very... I didn't take much to make me to drink, but even today, I don't suffer as much. You know, I've been through loss of a career, 30-year career, loved ones dying unexpectedly, you know, cancer within loved ones, all of this. And I know that I'm okay. You know why? Because I haven't picked up a drink, you know, which, of course, is, the benefit of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I'm going to end with this, but it's my favorite. I call it the last promise in the book. It's on page 164. It says, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. And that has materialized in my life over and over and over again in many ways. And if I can't find one, like, hey, you know, that didn't work out. The great fact for me is that it's way past noon and I am not shit-faced. So right there, I can always go back to that. No matter what's going on in my life, if I haven't picked up a drink, I'm a success, period. You know, and I rely on that. And I go to meetings and hang around AA to find out what happens when people don't do that. You know, you know, it's disease is cunning, baffling, powerful, and very, very, very patient. Doesn't matter how long it's been since your last drink. I'm just a bad attitude, and I'm lights away from a drunk. So, thank God I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you all for listening to me. Thank you.
Let's see if Joe will stick around a few minutes after, so you can thank him if you'd like. And thank you to Vicki, Lynn, and Glenn for reading. Thank you, Glenn, for making coffee when you got here. I appreciate it. And we don't know who's speaking next month yet, and And we don't know what will happen, if we'll even be open then. So, but you guys, thank you so much for coming. And this was, you know, this is so perfect how it all worked out. And yeah,
thank
and
you,
Joe,
thank you guys.
I'm glad to be here. So, all right. And Janet, would you like to pray us out in the prayer of your choice?